Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Hey everybody, Brett here. Are you new? Do you not understand why today's show is a big deal just by the name and the title? Thaddeus, for those of you who don't know, is an historian and an author. He spent, believe it or not, the last 30 years in academia in one form or another. During that time, he took a few notes, folks, on some things he'd like to see improved as far as learner experience is concerned. And he is here today to talk about the development of his very own online university, the Renegade University. But that subject really just opens the door to a very free, fast, and furious discussion about developments in the news over the course of 2016. And we agree on almost everything today. It's really neat. I think you're going to like it. So let's talk about how we, the School Sucks community, can help out Thad. I said in the introduction to the previous podcast, Thad has been a great friend to the show, even though we don't always get along, going back to 2013. And he is especially interested right now in reaching out to home educating parents and home educated or self-educating learners. Thad also has very impressive credentials on paper, PhD from Columbia University. And I think those of you who have heard Thad on the show before or sat in one of his classrooms would agree that he blends those impressive credentials on paper with actual teaching competence and some attunement with what's happening in the real world. A very rare combination of features for an academic. So yes, Thad got his PhD in history from Columbia University. And you might be saying, Brett, haven't you told us before that's where all the worst people come from? I think you're thinking more Columbia Teachers College. Tom Woods went to Columbia University. John Taylor Gatto went to Columbia University. So hooray, Columbia University. So again, if you haven't heard the series, A Renegade History Course, go back and find the archives. You go to schoolsucksproject.com. It's in the series drop-down menu, A Renegade History Course. Pick any one of those shows that, I'd say listen to the whole series, but really pick any one of those shows that interests you and listen to this man tell some stories. I can guarantee you're definitely going to be challenged and entertained. And speaking of challenges, I'm sure there is some people in the audience who are saying, Brett, I've heard this man on your show before, and he said some things that I found disturbing. Yeah, he's probably going to do it again today. But if that creates some apprehension about exposing your teenager or even yourself to one of his courses, I think that today's discussion will assuage some of those concerns because we are going to talk in some detail about the importance of debate in education, especially in quote-unquote higher education, where it is surprisingly slash not surprisingly almost completely absent. So if you are somebody or if you know somebody interested in further education in the areas of American history, philosophy, and political ideas, and you want really challenging examinations of these subjects that you're not going to find anywhere else, the first step would be to go to Thad's website. It's ThaddeusRussell.com. There's two D's in Thaddeus. There's two S's and two L's in Russell.com. And join his mailing list to get updates about the developments of Renegade University. And I'm sure he would really appreciate some input and some feedback from the people in this audience as well. I learned in the discussion today that Thad has left Occidental College. Hooray! Remember that place from the last show Thad and I did together? Good heavens. So I'm excited to see him succeed on this new venture. The website again, ThaddeusRussell.com. And get on his mailing list and hopefully you can have some dialogue with him that will help make the Renegade University successful. And I have some School Sucks related announcements, but I'm going to save them for the end of the show. Thanks for listening, everybody. Here he is, one of our favorite guests, without a doubt, Thaddeus Russell. Built a shock. Hey, Thad.
Hey, man. How are you?
I'm doing well. We haven't talked since the end of last year. It feels like we live in a different world, and I think we're going to get into some of that today. We actually have a very exciting and constructive topic to cover here first. There's been some buzz in my audience going back a few months about your development of the Renegade University. Where are you at with this?
Yeah, I am. Right now I'm recording video lectures for the Renegade History of the United States course. And I am locating classrooms across the country for the in-person seminars that will also be part of the university, and putting together a team of web people and videographers and graphic animation people and teaching assistants. And we're going to launch in the fall.
So what made you decide to do this?
I mean, it's the kind of thing I always wanted to do, but then technology made it possible in the last few years.
Yeah.
When I was, this started at the very, very, very beginning of my academic career, which is pretty much the first week in college. I would sit in classes, and I went to a college that I liked quite a bit, actually, but, most of the teachers were pretty bad, actually. Most college teachers are pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I would sit there, and I realized after a few weeks that I was spending most of my time thinking about how I would teach this course differently.
Oh, yeah? Yeah.
I think I would spend more time on that than on the subject matter itself. And I guess that sort of dawned on me at some point when I was a college student that I was really cut out to be a teacher.
You would say almost through and through all the professors that you dealt with when you were at Antioch and beyond were unacceptable. Did you have any good professors?
Yeah. No, I had one tremendous professor who I took like 9 courses with at Antioch.
Yeah.
And he taught me a lot about how to be a good teacher. And then I had one other guy who was a good professor in that he would challenge us to think. He wouldn't just let these things, ideas pass by unchallenged, which you get a lot, especially in the liberal classroom. There's a lot of so-called tolerance, which basically translates into anti-intellectual patronizing.
So you mean, I get what you're, anti-intellectual patronizing is a fine expansion on what you mean by tolerance.
Whatever you say, there's no sort of direct challenging of ideas, right? Mm-hmm. But anyway, this one guy didn't do that. He was quite brilliant too. But yeah, so I really appreciated that. I thought, wow, I was a socialist then. And I remember this was actually the moment I said something socialist and stupid. And he just drew, he turned around and said, okay, let me get this straight. He turned around, drew on the board like a picture of his head. And by the way, he was like a black socialist, radical guy, but he had like lots of skepticism about his own ideas. He turned around, drew a picture of a house on the wall, on the board. And he said, so let me get this straight. If I want to add an addition to my house, then he drew the addition. That would not be okay with you unless the polity voted on it. And it just made me think through my own ideas of how would we allow him to make an addition to his house as a socialist republic, And so that was the kind of thing that I really appreciated. So I had 2 college professors who were good out of, 50 or 60 of them. Most of them were really, really bad and just quite boring and unengaging. And then in graduate school at Columbia, there was one professor there, very prominent American historian named Richard Bushman, who was pretty good. He was pretty good. He would actually talk to you in the classroom. That was the thing I really understood as being what teaching is about establishing an intimate intellectual relationship with each student.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what it's about, actually finding out what you're thinking and then talking about it and tracking it, tracking your ideas, treating you seriously, taking you seriously as an intellectual.
Before you encountered these 2 professors, how did you feel about yourself intellectually? Because I know, I have a very similar story. Like, it was one professor in college. I actually tried not too long ago to get him on the show, and I think he took a look at the website, and he wasn't particularly interested in mixing it up with me. I don't think he wanted to participate in this whole libertarian scene or whatever he interpreted it to be. But this was a professor that I avoided for years. Unfortunately, he taught some of the core curriculum, even though I was a communications major. You had to take a government class. You had to take like Western Civ. And I heard he was really difficult. And then when I finally, there was nothing left for me to take except his class, I really flourished in there. And I really, for the first time since maybe, the time we all believe in ourselves intellectually when we're like in third grade, I said, wow, you know, maybe I have an aptitude for something that is academic. It's unfortunate that I found out about it when I was, you know, 20 years old. How about you?
Yeah, same thing. Yeah. I had no idea if I was smart or not until I was in college. I just didn't know. And I was quite insecure about it. But I certainly had no idea that I could be an intellectual, or certainly not a professional intellectual, until sometime in college. There was just this moment, because that's when I became free to actually explore ideas on my own rather than be led by the hand. You know, I was in public schools my entire childhood, you know, and Antioch was private. And Antioch had all kinds of problems, and it's a silly little hippie punk rock school, but it gave you tremendous freedom. And so if you came in with an intellectual aptitude and, of course, curiosity about ideas, it was wonderful, because they sort of just said, here's the library, here's some books we recommend you read, what do you think of them? Mm-hmm. That was essentially the pedagogy. It really was. Then I just took off. I mean, immediately. I mean, the first week, I was just flying and loving it, and realizing this is where I was meant to be. Little did I know, I didn't know really about the sort of politics and culture of academia broadly. I was naive about that, of course, but, you know, so therefore I thought I should be a college professor also that first week or two.
Yeah.
But then I found out later, you know, that wasn't all it was cracked up to be. So I had no idea that I could do that kind of thing. I mean, I was a C student in high school. I got many, many D's, rarely got an A. Hated it all the time. Just, I hated every minute of school until college. So,
yeah. The reason why I wanted to go down that path with you is I was thinking, like, you've been immersed in academia in one form or another as a student or some type of teacher for like 30 years. And now we're hearing a lot of these conversations, and we've certainly had a few on my show, that, you know, this culture, this environment, this institution is basically just spinning out of control. I talked to a guy, a professor from Arizona State University, at the end of last year. He's like, maybe this has 15 years left before it's just like a complete meltdown. Like, and he was saying, like, every institution, even the most established institutions, they're not going to be able to justify the existence of this thing much longer. With the perspective that you have, do you see, especially in what's developed in the last year, especially what we talked about the last time you were on my show, with a lot of what was happening at Mizzou and Dartmouth and Occidental,
right?
With your perspective, are things significantly worse now, or has the environment always been kind of poisonous to free thought, free expression, etc.?
Oh yeah, always.
I mean,
I don't know. I mean, I'm not in most people's classrooms, so I can't really say, but I certainly know what professors say outside the classroom. And I've heard lots of things from students about what other teachers do in classrooms. So, you know, I'm pretty confident there's never been very good teaching going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to remember that academia, it trains people to be scholars. It doesn't train them to be teachers. I spent 8 years in graduate school at Columbia University.
Mm-hmm.
They spent exactly 0 minutes training me to be a teacher in a classroom. Not one thing. Not 1 minute was spent on talking to us about how to teach. And they just said, you know, in our third year, we became TAs, teaching assistants, which is really being a teacher, a classroom teacher. And they said, there you go. Your section meets on Wednesday at 11 o'clock.
Now, I'm sorry if I'm confusing you with a few other Columbia alumni, including Gatto and Tom Woods. Did you go to Columbia Teachers College?
No.
Okay.
Columbia University.
I was
in Tom Woods and I were in the same program.
Okay.
At the same time. He was a little bit, just a couple years after me. But I mean, we were there at the same time, though. I mean, he was there. He started 2 years after me. But
the understanding was that everyone who was there was training to basically be an academic.
We were training to be historians.
Okay. All right.
That was it. That was the only thing. The only thing they care about is the books that you will write.
All right.
That's the only. I mean, I'm not kidding. That is the only thing that matters in that world.
Yeah, I remember looking into it because I was interested in it at one time. And it was like, you know, you need to be credentialed. And I used to train people to do this, to teach in like middle school and high school. But I never found anything about how to, you know, succeed as a professor, as a teacher in one of these institutions. All you needed was either, depending on where you were going, a master's or a PhD. I always found that curious.
Yeah, so there's zero training for classroom teaching. And also, it attracts a particular kind of narcissist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not, I'm not anti-narcissism, actually, but I mean, there are various kinds of narcissism. You know, some I prefer right. to others. This kind of narcissism would lead one to lecture for an hour and a half straight without ever checking in with the audience.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And
yeah.
You've seen this. We've all seen this. We've all seen lecturers just talk for an hour and a half, no matter how it's going, no matter what the response in the audience is. They don't care if people are falling asleep. They just keep going. They don't even seem to notice. That always blew me away. Like when I lecture, and if I'm lecturing to 150 or 200 people, and I see one person lose attention just for a second, I panic. I need to at least feel like I'm holding the attention of every single person in that room. That's my narcissism. That's a different kind of narcissism. I don't know what the other kind is called, but it's academia tends to attract people who are solitary people. They're sort of not social people. They like to spend a lot of time with books in their study. That's what they're there for. Mm-hmm. That's what brought them into those halls, was to do that kind of thing forever, not to teach, not to be social. Now, of course, there are exceptions. I mean, I've known some people who are really into teaching who have PhDs. And as I said, you know, there were two in college that I had and one or two in graduate school who were pretty good. But that's still remarkably bad. That's very, very few people.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to think about it. I just think my well is very poisoned generally towards the whole lot. Whenever it comes up, I just have this immediate negative response to college professor, academic. I don't know if I'm paranoid to think, I know you said you can't see in every classroom, but I feel like from my interactions with some of these people, a lot of these people, they are there to indoctrinate, like openly.
Well, yeah,
you know?
Yeah, we haven't talked about that, of course. Yeah. That's also part of it. Now, I think that's a little overplayed.
Okay.
By people on our side. I mean, I know that goes on. I mean, don't get me wrong. I've known quite a few. I think what actually is more common is people who are, so there's the indoctrination really goes on sort of explicitly and consciously by sort of hard left types.
Yeah.
Right. They're doing it and they know they're doing it and they're proud of it and they think that that's what they should be doing. I mean, I've heard them say this.
Right.
Honestly, you know. They're a significant percentage of college professors, but they're still a minority. The vast majority of college professors in the humanities and social sciences are liberals. Mm-hmm. They're very mainstream, conventional liberals, which means that they don't really have to think about their own ideology. In fact, most of them are unaware that they possess an ideology, right? Because it's like it's the air they breathe. It's the de facto position. Their set of ideas is the de facto, you know, standard, respectable. So they never think, oh, I'm a liberal. They never once think that. No one ever says to them, oh, my friend, the liberal John so-and-so,
right?
Unlike you and libertarians or conservatives or socialists, it's always like, oh, the libertarian guy, oh, he's a libertarian or so-and-so is a socialist or a Marxist, right? These people walk around, this is just their home. They're just at home.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Liberal,
that's a good point.
When you're liberal, it's like your house, man. You're in your house. No one ever points out that you're in a particular kind of house. People like you and me and others who are dissenters, you know, it's always pointed out we're in someone else's house. So those people, they're so comfortable, right? Because the air is their own air. They often don't feel the need to indoctrinate.
Uh-huh.
Right. It's they kind of run the joint to begin with. That's what I've sensed among liberal colleagues. They don't feel this urgent need to convert the students because most of the students are liberals too. Not, you know, 100%, but certainly most. So now does that mean there's an indoctrination going on? Of course there is, right? You know, everything they teach, all the selections on the syllabus, et cetera, that's all meant to sort of steer students in a particular direction, but it's just not conscious and it's not deliberate. They don't know that they're doing it.
Right. Yeah.
That makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I would think that kind of insularity, there must be some awareness of that. And I would even think, and maybe I'm just putting myself in their shoes, I would even think that if I was in an environment that was that closed, that was that insular, where there was that much positive reinforcement for my beliefs, and I think that's part of the appeal of maybe teaching in that environment, is you're just kind of getting your belief system echoed back to you by students.
Oh, yeah.
I would think that for a fairly self-aware person, a kind of insecurity would develop where you would, you know, want to protect yourself from the outside world. You would resist challenge intellectually because
oh, sure.
I would think that, you know, a decade, two decades, you would become very fragile. I don't, you know, see a lot of these academics out there debating people with different belief systems. But not enough of them, considering how many there are.
Almost never. And by the way, as soon as Renegade University has the means, which I hope will be by the spring of next year, one of the courses I will introduce will be debate courses, in which Marxists will debate social conservatives, who will debate classical liberals, who will debate New Deal liberals, who will debate libertarians, who will debate anarchists.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm talking about high level people, you know, very, very smart people who are bringing the best arguments to bear. That was one thing I really wanted in my first year in college. I wanted to see, you know, the best minds go at it, people with real fundamental differences. And I never got that. Never got that. 4.5 years in college, 8 years in graduate school, I never saw that in a classroom. I never once saw that in a classroom.
Right.
Where you would have someone representing Hayek debating someone representing Marx, for instance. Never saw a real debate, a real clash of ideas.
So I have this friend, his name's Robert Murphy, and he's an economist. And him and Tom Woods actually do a podcast about Paul Krugman.
Contra Krugman.
Yeah. And, you know, poor Bob has been, gosh, for as long as I have known him, trying to get Paul Krugman into a debate, where he's done these elaborate schemes like raising money in Paul Krugman's name to give to a charity if he just showed up, costumes and skits and all kinds of YouTube campaigns. And I remember hearing Krugman say something about it, like, why would I debate him? You know, who is he? What use are his ideas?
Why would the king debate the peasant?
Exactly. So I didn't want to extrapolate that to all of academia, but I definitely think that there is plenty of that kind of attitude.
They own the place. Yeah. Once again, it's their house.
Right.
You know, they furnished it. They decorated it. They built it. It is their house. Why on earth would you let someone who doesn't like you into your house?
Exactly. All right. So we've established that institution is bullshit. Let's talk about some exciting alternatives developing in the 21st century, including Renegade University. I'm really inspired. I think this is great. This is actually a path that I'm looking to go down in the next year or so as well, developing online courses. And I just wanted to actually hear, this is a bit of a selfish question, but I just wanted to hear a little bit about your process that, you know, researching, trying to find what interest is out there, who you're marketing this to, and where all that's at.
Yeah. So I have a newsletter. People have subscribed to the newsletter. I have right so far 1,500 subscribers to the Renegade University newsletter. And that was just from through my website. I've done very little promotion so far and sort of podcast appearances and stuff. But, I had them take a survey, with about 19 questions on it, sort of asking them what they wanted me to teach and what kinds of courses they wanted and how much money they'd be willing to pay for it, and where they'd want these courses and whether they'd want them to be online lectures or in-person seminars. And so I found that the most popular formats were online lectures that they can download as either audio or video, and interactive seminars with me, and online interactive seminars, and then in-person seminars. So, and then I found that in several cities, I have enough interest to do it. So I'm hoping to have in-person classes in Portland, Oregon, San Francisco Bay Area, Los Angeles, New York City, Chicago, Austin, Texas.
Awesome.
And maybe some more too, but those look pretty solid. Yeah. So launching in the fall, and also I found out that what people are interested in terms of topics are topics from my book, Renegade History of the United States. So there's the first video lectures will be on that. Mm-hmm. I'm doing a series of 13 lectures on Renegade History with material that's not included in the book as well, by the way.
Sure.
There's going to be every lecture will have material that you will not find in the book. A lot of stuff that I talk about in my own actual classes as a professor that never made it into the book. And then topics on my current book project, which is a history, my own history of American foreign policy and foreign relations and globalization, the spread of popular culture abroad over the last 200 years.
This is Blood and Freedom.
Blood and Freedom.
Yep.
Yeah. Blowback theory applied to 150 years of American foreign policy, the connections between progressivism and imperialism, over the whole sweep, beginning with the Civil War, really, and going forward, which Civil War I treat as foreign policy, of course.
But that has a little overlap, that book, doesn't it? With actually, let's put a bookmark in that, because I want to talk about Blood and Freedom, and I don't want to derail the whole Renegade University conversation yet. Have you been able to make any generalizations about who these people, like, let's say the people on your newsletter, who they are and where they're coming from?
Right. So a lot of homeschoolers.
Cool.
Which is great. And I hope I would love for this to take off among homeschoolers. A lot of everybody. I mean, I have, you know, a lot of .edu email addresses, which is the most exciting thing, you know. I mean, actual renegades in the belly of the beast there trying to get out. Lots of college students. I have something like 10% do not have a high school, 5% do not have a high school diploma, and about 10% have a PhD, and then everybody in between. So, you know, it's all age. I have 13-year-olds and 14-year-olds and 15-year-olds, and then I have 70-year-olds and 80-year-olds too. I have every state, every city, lots of people from Australia, the UK, and some other countries too. Yeah, so it's a really exciting broad base.
Did you set out with any kind of ideal avatar or student, the person you wanted to teach to?
Someone who's curious.
That's it?
That's it. Yeah, I mean, really, that's it. I just want someone who's genuinely curious. It doesn't mean you can't come in with a set of ideas or even an ideology. Just be willing to talk about it. Be willing to really talk about it.
Excellent.
Be willing to take whatever ideas you have, and at least for that hour or 2 hours, be willing to turn them upside down, turn them entirely upside down, and look at them from that vantage point, just for those 2 hours. And then when you leave the class, you can go back to thinking how you thought before. But for the time you're in my classroom, whether it's virtual or brick and mortar, turn your ideas completely upside down and look at them anew.
Interesting. So in these face-to-face settings, are you worried about any chaos like what you've experienced on this show in the past? Have you kind of formulated a way to make that exchange of ideas work in person with, like, say you're looking out at a group of 15, 20 people who are somewhat incredulous? Have you thought about how that's going to work?
Oh, that's the most exciting thing.
I agree.
I've been a classroom teacher for 20 years, and I love it. And I've always loved it. I've always been very, very good at it. My classes are a blast. They just always are. They're just always a lot of fun and simultaneously rigorous. And I've always said this to my students. I mean, if we're just having fun, we may as well go bowling. And if it's just rigorous, I don't really want to do this for a living. You know, I want to have fun and think hard at the same time. And my classes are always that way. So, I mean, that's what we're shooting for. And I also love teaching adults, and I'm sure, I would imagine most of my students, not all, but most will be adult age, post-college age, because they're there for only one reason. They're interested. They're curious, right? They're not there for the credential. There is no credential here.
Right, right.
They're there for only to learn, only to think, only to explore ideas. That's the only reason they're there. And that's who I want to teach. And I don't care if you've been to college or not, if you have a PhD or not, if you've even finished high school or not. I don't care. My ideal student in some ways is like a Joe Rogan fan, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, generally speaking, and Joe Rogan is this way too. Basically no college education, but intensely curious about the world. And when the internet came along, Joe just dove in. He had, you know, a set of interests. He had 10 or 20 things he was interested in, and he just researched all the way to the bottom those topics. And he's basically an expert on a bunch of topics without any formal training. And he's just really curious. I just love that. You know, you can just talk to him about anything, and he'll ask questions and never stop asking questions. And I found that, you know, because I now have a lot of his fans are my fans now because of being on his podcast. I mean, I found that a lot of his fans are the same way. They're not academic in any formal way, but they just want to know about stuff. And they also they really love, they love just anything that's unconventional, any unconventional view of the world. Now, that often leads them to ideas that I think are silly or even bullshit.
No, you bet. Yeah. Doesn't. Yeah.
But I love that attitude. It doesn't matter. The point is that there's an attitude that there are no settled questions.
Sure. My exposure to Rogan, it actually, you know, contributed to changing my show's format back in 2013, where before it was much more of an echo chamber. on this philosophy of liberty. And, you know, I was really interested in bringing in new people and playing more of an inquisitive role, which is how you ultimately wound up on the show, like trying to seek people like you out to say, okay, here's somebody who's really smart and exciting, but challenging. And yeah, he's very, very good at rounding up, you know, people who are absolutely brilliant and people who really, really piss me off. I'm sure you've encountered the same. So if this takes off, the Renegade University, will you leave Occidental?
I already have.
Whoa. Okay.
So I am currently splitting time between Salem, Oregon and Los Angeles. My son's mother lives in Los Angeles, and my girlfriend slash sort of wife is a vice president at Willamette University in Salem. And Willamette gave me a part-time teaching gig. So I'm actually now teaching at Willamette University.
How recent is that?
Part-time. Just happened.
Just the happened. Last couple. Yeah, okay, so you left Occidental after the spring semester.
School year. Right.
All right, so let me ask you this. Last time we talked, we were, I don't know, maybe halfway through the fall semester. How did things develop over the course of that year with a lot of what we were seeing in the news? And you know, I think our last conversation, we talked a lot about, you know, the impact of racial liberalism, and it seemed like there was a lot of consciousness about that at the Occidental campus. Did things improve? Did things get worse? Was there any rethinking of this problem where minority students are brought into these universities and basically treated like they're part of a diorama? You know, for the white students, everything that happened last year, did you see any positive developments in that conversation, or did things take a turn for the worse?
Oh, yeah. There was the very deep examination of racial liberalism. Oh, yeah. They all sat around. They had these intensive week-long seminars on, you know, the origins of racial liberalism and whether it should be dismantled. No, of course not. They nothing. I don't know. I mean, it just continues. It's just the stasis. It's disgusting. I just became so disgusted. I basically withdrew, stopped going to faculty meetings. You know, I would see stuff on the listservs from faculty, but I don't know. This is the thing. They're not interested in really examining their own ideas. And so nothing really changes.
Right.
It's going to have to change from without, which it is. Right. So what's changing from without is, from outside the university, is podcasts. You know, what's changing from without is the web and blogs and Twitter and people talking and reading and thinking and researching everything on their own. The whole world outside the university is just reshaping the landscape. And I don't know how the university is holding itself up. I mean, when we can crack their credential power, they're done. That's the only thing they have. When employers stop respecting the credential, they're toast. There is no reason for those things to exist.
Right.
In colleges. But that's all they have. I mean, I've said this publicly, there is way more rigorous intellectual debate in 5 minutes on Twitter than there is in a college classroom.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear you say that, because the last time we talked, I was becoming aware of the fact that I was developing a real cynicism about the future of what I do. You know, I see how much gravity a lot of these movements and types of awareness, if you want to call it that, these protests that are happening on college campuses, Black Lives Matter, the rise of Bernie Sanders, which someone in my audience did want you to comment on.
Sure.
And I said, very cynically and very kind of in a self-defeated way, I said, all these things are stealing my audience. You know, those people, like, I thought that I had a message that if I could just find these young people, I'm not thinking like this anymore, but I went through a month of really like, hey, there they all go, the way of Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders and Black Lives Matter, and they should be awake. But you're saying no. And I agree with you now, but let me hear your thoughts.
Yeah, no, you're a part of what is really going on. And I think there's a spin, and I don't think it's a spin because I think it's really true. I mean, about the Trump and Sanders phenomena, you know, it's the positive spin, which is that it's going a long way toward dissolution of the two-party duopoly. I mean, this is big. I mean, and I don't mean just institutionally, but I mean ideologically, intellectually, politically, culturally, right? And so that Bernie's a fucking nitwit. But he's saying things that you weren't allowed to say in the Democratic Party just 4 years ago.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right? Okay. Well, that's good in itself. Trump is a fucking authoritarian nitwit. Well, they're both authoritarian nitwits. Who's saying things you definitely weren't allowed to say anywhere.
Right.
Just a year ago. Okay. and some of it, and some of what Trump is saying, some of it is abominable from my perspective, but some of it's pretty damn good. Like, why do we have NATO? Like, the Iraq war was a terrible waste of time, worse than a waste of time. It was self-defeating, et cetera. But my point is that they're both expanding political discourse in this country.
Yeah.
And I think there's a very good chance the Republican Party will split. And I think there's a decent chance the Democratic Party will split. Great stuff for everyone. We're seeing a splintering of American politics, which is exactly what we want. Not just a splintering, not just a breaking apart, but we're seeing the edges grow, right?
Yeah.
There's way more room. There's way more people on the outside of that very narrow discourse than ever, and certainly in my lifetime, way more.
Right, right.
So you have to remember, people your age and younger don't quite get it, like how narrow political discourse was in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. There were three television networks, each with its nightly news. That's how people got their news. All three saying exactly the same thing. I mean, seriously, exactly the same thing. That was it. And PBS, which said exactly the same thing, but with a sort of, with a British accent.
Right.
And the Democrats and the Republicans were the whole game. That was it. There was a very, very small socialist edge fringe, which I was a part of, but they had zero effect in national politics. I mean, I know because I was in that movement. It was just like whenever we heard a Democrat say anything that might have been even slightly socialist, we would have an orgasm because it was so rare.
Right.
Like the stuff Bernie's saying now, that's what my socialist club in college was saying every single day.
Yeah, and there was nowhere for it to go.
Yeah, and it was just everything was locked down with respectability politics. The shit that Trump says, just the rhetoric, the way he talks about things, forget it. Impossible. You never see that on television, ever. You would certainly never see it in a political candidate. So there's a breaking apart of political discourse, the institutions, the categories in this country that is a great thing for people like you and me who have never been part of the center.
Right, absolutely.
And so what you've been doing, I mean this, you know, I have no doubt in my mind that School Sucks has had some part in that.
Oh, I appreciate you saying so.
There's no doubt about it. Of course, there's no doubt about it. You're not the only one, you know. I mean, there's other podcasts too, and other people, you know, operating in this new space who have been saying things that you're not supposed to say, saying things that you're not supposed to say for several years now, right? And there's no doubt that contributed to what's going on nationally.
Do you think this splintering of these parties, do you see this as something that's going to happen, like that we're just seeing the beginning of this now? Or do you think this is something that's going to happen very rapidly, like possibly even this month for the Republicans when they have their convention? Do you see this as a long-term thing or something that's going to happen very quickly?
I have no idea. I just hope it happens. I think it will happen. I can't guarantee. I know I try not to make predictions, but
right.
It's certainly looking like the Republicans. I don't see that bizarre. It was always a bizarre coalition, right?
The
sort of modern Republican Party. It never made sense for libertarians to be hanging out with Christian conservatives.
Yeah.
You know, and in some ways it was inevitable, the splitting apart. I can't imagine, and now with Trump, now there's like this populist, sort of right-wing populist portion represented by Trump. So that's like a third grouping, right? Sort of Tea Party, populist, Trumpist. So there's like, I see it going in three directions. I think there could be three parties coming out of the Republican Party. And then the Democrats, I mean, that's always been sort of an awkward coalition as well. It's been sort of like social Democrats, like Bernie Sanders, they're not really socialists, but so certainly social Democrats of the Scandinavian variety with Clintonite type liberals, you know, who want, you know, very modified social welfare state, very hawkish on foreign policy, terrible on civil liberties, bad on immigration, et cetera, et cetera. Those groups have never really gotten along, you know, and they don't really belong in the same party. And now the social democratic wing, the Sanders people, are angry. They're agitated. They're mobilized. And they're fury for the first time in my whole life. Here's the thing. For the first time in my whole life, the fury of the left in this country is primarily directed at Democrats. I have never seen this in my life. When I was a lefty, that's what I always wanted. The true lefties hated the Democrats and were always like, why are you giving these motherfuckers a pass every November? Why? You should be, they're the real problem. They're the real problem. This is finally happening. It's finally come to fruition. You see true lefties in the Democrat, just generally in the Democratic Party and elsewhere, being furious primarily at Clinton and right. The establishment Democrats. That's a very healthy thing. That's a very, very healthy, it's a very healthy attitude to sort of be postpartisan. And for all the things you can say about Black Lives Matter, and I've been increasingly irritated with them. I think maybe the best thing about them, and this is a really great thing, is that they kind of led the way there. They were offering critiques of the Democratic Party from the get-go. They were the ones, and they were even going after Bernie Sanders. But the whole, they were had an absolutely correct view of the Democratic Party, which was that they were the heads of the police state.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Oh, they have been forever.
Yeah, but the BLM, I'm telling you, they were the ones who made that critique popular. They really were. They were totally right. I couldn't believe when they first started jumping on Bernie Sanders' stages, et cetera, and talking about the Clintons and the crime bill of 1994, et cetera, et cetera. It was like just phenomenal to see this happening, to see, you know, people being, oh, right, the Democratic Party is the one who built the prisons.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So this is all very, very healthy.
Well, yeah. And I like the idea of Sanders' exposure over the course of the last year, because I think the things he's saying are things that high school teachers say to high school students who don't have any economics education. And I think that college professors say these things to college students who have no economics education. And sunlight is a great disinfectant, because now Bernie Sanders is saying these things, not behind the closed doors of a classroom, but to the entire world. And you can watch his Twitter just light up when he says I can't think of an example off the top of my head, but he gets 100 responses debunking whatever his claim is. And I think that's terrific.
Yeah. I think you're totally, I've been thinking about Bernie, like his intellect lately, and I think you've nailed it. He's like a high school teacher. He's that lefty high school teacher. He's the yes. one lefty high school teacher. Totally. He's a simple motherfucker, isn't he? He really is. He's simple. Like, I don't know why it took me so long to get there, because I always sort of assumed for no good reason that, you know, because he's a socialist, he must be an intellectual. He's not. He's not at all. That guy hasn't had an original idea since 1975.
Absolutely.
Yes, I think this is all good. And I think what you're doing and podcasting generally and new media even more generally is primarily responsible for all the good stuff that's happening politically in this country.
Well, absolutely. I certainly hope so. And I agree. I've seen a lot of that, too. And, you know, I think that while there's sophisticated criticism of Sanders, I am longing for some sophisticated criticism of Trump that isn't just blowing whistles and, you know, stopping public speaking engagements and dumping pee on people. While Sanders' popularity is a symptom of one set of problems. Obviously, Trump's popularity is a symptom of another set of problems.
Hang on. I mean, I do think there is a huge amount of criticism, very intelligent criticism of both of them, which is also a great thing that's happening as well. Like, don't you think?
Where's it coming from on the Trump criticism side? Where do you see it coming from?
The entire pundit class, all of academia. I mean, what do you mean? Like, Trump is who is pro Trump in media, new or old media? Who's pro Trump? No one.
Yeah, but why are they anti Trump? See, this is the I was talking to my dad yesterday. My dad's a conservative, and he says, I don't know, I think I'm gonna have to vote for Donald Trump. I tried to explain to him that you can just stay home that day. But a year ago, he was like, this guy's a ridiculous clown. He went to see him in Florida. He's like, I can't believe the things this guy said and did.
Is this party loyalty for him?
It really is just party loyalty for him. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem like, you know, you talk about the pundit class. What are some names of people who've provided sophisticated criticism of Trump? Because I don't see it.
Well, okay. So what's unsophisticated? You mean the unsophisticated criticism is
racist?
The kids who punch his supporters in the face and throw piss on people. And
yeah, but there's
like
a rhetorical version of that. There's a rhetorical version of that too, where you say he's a racist, he's a xenophobe. Yeah. Calling somebody a racist is like calling somebody a booger. You know.
It's, it's meaningless. It's meaningless. No, of course. Yeah, there's plenty of that too. I mean, there's just a lot of everything. I mean, this is what's so great about this moment in history. There's a lot of, there's just everything out there. Mm-hmm. Again, God, I wish people under 40 could just go back to the 1970s for a minute and check it out. I mean, it was like none of this stuff was happening. Certainly on the national stage, there was just none. I mean, there's just fierce debate all the time. Anyway, you know, I mean, I've seen, you know, just countless in-depth critiques. We've had this whole new debate about trade because of Trump, mm-hmm. which is great.
I agree.
You know, that's basically a response to Trump and Sanders.
Yes.
Because they're both shitting on it. They're both protectionists.
And a footnote while I think of it, Ben Shapiro actually does a good job against Trump, among other things. Yeah.
Yeah, even though I'm not, of course, a social conservative.
Right.
Like that guy, he should be. See, my dream is to have, is to force lefties. Well, actually, it happened. Sally Cohn debated him.
Mm-hmm.
Just like last week. I want, because he's so good at debating and at polemics. You know, force lefties to debate that guy. And he's not always right. I mean,
no,
he's not perfect, but damn, he's good. And he's really principled too.
Yeah.
He's not Milo. He's really principled and really smart and treats his opponents with respect, you know, which is rare. So anyway, I've seen just lots and lots and lots and lots of high level analysis of trade policy, trade as an idea because of Trump and Sanders. I've seen lots of, you know, the whole open immigration, open borders question is like, people are talking about open borders.
Right.
You know, like whether you're for it or against it, like we're talking about it because of those knuckleheads. I'm pro universal basic income. I know a lot of libertarians are not, although some are, whatever, it doesn't matter. Again, we're talking about these things.
Well, there's arguments for it.
Sanders.
Yeah. I mean, there's arguments for it that never would have occurred to me. Like there's an economic argument. I haven't studied it that much, but the economic argument that it would actually be cheaper to just provide this than continue to maintain the current welfare state.
Right. And it takes the strings that the state has on us away. There's many, many fewer strings attached to the people by it. Anyway, I mean, there are libertarian arguments for it. Regardless, my point, it doesn't matter what your position is. My point is that, again, we're having national conversations about these things that just a few years ago were crazy radical fringe ideas that never would have made it into NPR or the New York Times.
Do you think that let's use Trump as an example here. Do you think that his rise has opened a door for people like Milo? Because it's hard to believe, but since the last time I spoke to you, Milo is a new phenomenon. Most people in my audience didn't know who he was the last time we talked. And now he's like the most, you did, but now he's like the most famous guy on Twitter. So
he's
as
just
you
getting going.
Yeah.
I think he was just getting going last fall. Yeah.
So as you watched what he did over the last 7 or 8 months, what were your impressions of him? That was one of the questions that my audience was interested in.
I mean, I'm just constantly struck by the massive, to me, obvious contradiction in what he's doing. It doesn't make any. So he's gay.
Mm-hmm.
Flamboyantly so, unabashedly so, loudly, deliberately gay. he's also Greek and British.
Mm-hmm.
And then talks about, ad nauseum, the virtues of Christianity, traditional American and British values, opposes immigration, and celebrates assimilation. Okay, so how does that work when you are when you talk about having sex with black men,
mm-hmm.
and your fucking name is Milo Yiannopoulos?
Right. All right. Well, here's my read on him.
My final point is, as listeners know, you know, Greek people not very long ago were not white. They were not considered white.
Right.
So what? It just doesn't make any sense to me. He calls himself a cultural libertarian, and that's great if he really were. So cultural libertarianism is traditional America's and Christianity's arch enemy. You can't be both. you can't say you're a cultural libertarian and also claim to be upholding Christian and traditional American values. Makes no sense.
Right. My read on him is that most of his support of things that are considered right wing are kind of ex post facto justifications for his opposition to the left. So you mentioned he is part of several minority groups. And the first time I ever heard him was on Rogan, probably a couple years ago at this point. I remember one time you were on my show and you described the relationship that black people have with the establishment left as being their sock puppets. And I love that line, and I use it every chance I get. I think he's identified that. I think he, as part of, you know, several groups that have been told by the left that you are aggrieved, you know, he recognizes that that's bullshit, and he sprinted to the other, what he saw as the other side. I think his discovery of libertarianism is something that is a more recent development than his alliance with an organization like Breitbart. And I think he's an exciting figure because even though he says a lot of stuff that I just find horrifying, he's a brilliant guy, you know? So I think that he is curious enough too, that he will start to wander into what we're doing. And I'd love to get him exposed to somebody like Tom Woods. I'm trying to think of other people, Tom Woods is kind of the guy right now.
Yeah, he was on Woods. He was on Tom's show.
Oh, terrific. Well, I hope that planted some seeds.
But Tom just threw him softballs, so whatever.
That'd be a good debate.
I think your analysis of him is right. I mean, I think your take on him is my take on him. His critiques of the left are all correct. What he says about the left is all right, yeah. Yeah, but and I think you're I the very smart analysis about being ex post facto justification for his. It's like he searched for a team too quickly to be on.
Well, yeah, I think when Rogan, the good thing about Rogan's show is that it's long and it's unedited, so you really get to know people. And Rogan is very challenging to him in that interview. It's probably like 150 shows ago at this point. Can see him kind of searching for justifications, right? Yeah. So that's why I feel safe speculating about, you know, how he walked the path that he walked. Because he really doesn't have strong arguments for a lot of the things that he believes culturally, religiously.
So I also hate his fat shaming. I really do. I just think that is just mean. And I get the point that there is among some feminists this attempt to, you know, politicize body image in a way that's absurd by calling it, you know, a product of the patriarchy or a rebellion against the patriarchy being overweight or whatever. But then it just becomes, he goes way out of his way to make fun of people who aren't political. I mean, he'll call people fat or ugly who aren't even political people, like Adele. I remember like when Adele's last album came out, he had this whole Twitter rant about how ugly she was and fat she was and how, of course, she never has a boyfriend. Of course, that's why her songs are all about ex-boyfriends, because that's all she can have is ex-boyfriends, etc. And it's not like I'm terribly concerned about Adele, but, you know, it's just, its effect will make a lot of people, a lot of women feel even worse about themselves.
Yeah.
And will have, I can see no positive political effect there.
Yeah. So he binds it to feminism. And that's where I think he gets his justification for.
I mean, there is that going on in feminism. Yeah. It's not like he's like, I've seen it happen, but it's also, I'd say what he's going after there is a very small portion of feminism. And believe me, I'm a huge critic of feminism, the way it's incarnated now. But anyway, a lot of his stuff is just plain mean and politically truly, truly reactionary, right? Meaning it's just a reaction, kind of going back to what you were saying about him.
Well, yeah, and this is huge right now, this alt-right radical reactionary movement that he is kind of oddly a hero in that. Yeah. And there's such strange things that come with that too. Like using Milo as an example, one of the things that he said is, you know, gay people should go back in the closet because they have higher IQs statistically. So they should go back in the closet, have sex with women, and then they can go out and fuck guys at night. But they need to, you know, especially white gay guys, because they need to continue to forward Western civilization. And if I ever had a chance to talk to him or somebody who's very similar to him, like Gavin McGinnis, I would say, you know, you guys talk about eugenics with the same enthusiasm. I wouldn't use the Nazis because, you know, yeah, you lose the debate. You said the Nazis as like early 20th century progressives. Like that's who you guys sound like when, you know, Gavin McGinnis, he'll, and Milo is the same way. They'll have a guy will call McGinnis's show. And he'll be like, how old are you? How many kids do you have? You're 32 and you're not married. How many kids do you think you can have by the time you're 40? You don't want to be a 40-year-old dad, you know, with a 2-year-old. And it's all just like social and family planning. and that's become, it's like terror management theory. Have you heard that term?
No.
This idea that, you know, you take radical Islam and what's happening with the migrant crisis in Europe. You superimpose it perfectly onto the United States. You say, that's what's happening to us. The thing that Milo and Gavin did in Orlando, I'm sure you saw that press conference, arm up gays against the invading radical Islamists. That idea, terror management theory is a term, it's more elaborate than what I'm going to do it very shorthand here. This idea that you recognize your own mortality, you almost become obsessed with your own mortality, and that kind of restructures your thinking about your life in the future. And one of the attributes of it is like this family planning stuff. I need to spread my seed, get married, have children. And if you listen to a lot of the conversation on the alt-right and in this reactionary movement, it's like white people, our days are numbered, have children, you know?
It's survivalism.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
It's fascinating. I find myself kind of lured into it just as a curious observer. I'm not going in that direction, but
super fun. Yeah, I mean, Gavin's the same way. I mean, everything I say about Milo applies to him as well. It's just, like, come on, man. Christian conservatives and traditional America, you know, are opposed to your lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't sort of go around talking about sex, casual sex, and drinking and partying and say you're a Christian conservative. You know, I just want someone to pull that question on them, to say, force them to deal with that. Like, are they just jokers? It could be just jokers, which is fine.
Well, that was my impression of them when I heard them both for the first time, that they're both trolls. But, you know, you gotta hand it to them. They've found their niche, right?
I don't think they are. I know that Gavin really cares about this stuff.
I think he does too. But they definitely both found a niche, even though you see them as having these contradictory viewpoints. They found a lot of people who seem to feel the same way. Western civilization and this idea of Western chauvinism. And this actually, if you have time for one more question, it's about your book,
sure.
Blood and Freedom, because it kind of relates to this in an interesting way. What is the mission? What is the story that you're trying to tell in Blood and Freedom? Because I know it talks a lot about U.S. foreign policy and blowback, but it also seems to have some of the cultural themes the other book had, right?
Yep. That America has exported both blood and freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning it's killed a lot of people and exported tremendous unfreedom through various forms of neocolonialism. But simultaneously, so that's the formal America, meaning the state government, has exported the blood and the colonialism and the control and the unfreedom. But all the while, simultaneously, there has been the exporting of cultural forms that have given people around the world tremendous pleasure, that has offered them new freedoms that they didn't know existed,
mm-hmm.
that they voluntarily became adherents to, and that freedom went a long way, in many cases, towards subverting the political regimes under which they themselves lived. So there has always been simultaneously the 82nd Airborne dropping bombs on people and Walt Disney sending movies to them that have worked at cross purposes.
Yeah.
And that's what people don't understand. They think that they often either don't think about the cultural stuff at all, or they think it's all of the same. So the left will think of both as both, but the same thing, right? They'll think that Walt Disney needs the 82nd Airborne to clear the way for those markets. It's completely false. I mean, there's just all sorts of historical evidence to show that, you know, like the phonograph, you know, it wasn't brought in by the military. People just they found out about it and they started buying it and shipping it into Egypt and France and China and Japan and the Philippines and started listening to jazz records in the 1910s on these phonographs. It had nothing to do with the military at all. In fact, military often worked against that. Whenever the military is involved, whenever there's a war, of course, it closes off trade routes. In fact, it retards that process. So they're not the same. They're actually antagonistic to one another. Which is also why the State Department and the Defense Department have rarely, if ever, tried to use American popular culture to expand its own foreign policy objectives, to advance its foreign policy objectives, because they've understood that you can't make a people under your control and give them punk rock at the same time, right? So that's the book.
You know, that's fascinating because I was thinking about it before you said all that in much simpler terms. And I was almost trying to relate it to the previous conversation about the alt-right, or this idea of Stefan Molyneux calls it the Freedom Club, you know, the gift of Western civilization to the world. And I think that, you know, conservatives have obviously made the deadly mistake of thinking that freedom comes after the smoke from the bombs clears, you know. And then the left and libertarians talk a lot like the left. We would speak up for this other culture, and we would say those people don't want this. They don't want freedom or whatever. And I'm trying to like back off that idea a little bit. I don't know what other people want. People in Iran want. I know if I listen to Ben Shapiro on that issue, you know, the deeper you take Islam into the Middle East, the more radical they all are, the more impenetrable those communities are. The more you move Islam to the West, let's say, because we're just talking about like recent conflicts, the more willing to assimilate they become. But if you talk to somebody like Ben Shapiro about what's the hope for spreading these ideas into Iran or Pakistan, he would say, well, look at these Pew Research polls where 85% of people in Iran said, you know, cut off this person's head because of X, Y, and Z. But that's not what you're finding.
Which ideas are we talking about? Right. So liberal democracy? No, not very popular.
Right.
I mean, I've seen very little evidence for that. Corporatist, American corporatist capitalism? Not so much. But look, everyone who's listening should Google Tehran and satellite dishes. And look, do a Google image search, and you will see giant apartment buildings all over Tehran, absolutely covered from top to bottom with satellite dishes. What do you think those satellite dishes are piping in to people's apartments, right? It's it's American TV shows.
Right.
And music videos and a whole lot of porn. The country that's, this is according to Google itself, the country for the last several years in a row that has searched the term sex more than any other country is Pakistan. And I'm sure Iran's not far behind. That is what the mullahs, the political Islamists, fear more than anything else. In fact, they're not really, as we all know, they're not really afraid of Western military intervention. They know that Western military intervention gives them new recruits. It pisses people off. It causes them to turn toward political Islamism when they get blown up.
Indeed, yeah.
This is online too. You can read the list of fatwas issued daily. Mullahs all across the Middle East issue fatwas, public, you know, denunciations of certain things. There's lists online. Read them, and you can see almost every day there's some fatwa against Kim Kardashian or T-shirts or tattoos or blue jeans or you name it. It goes on and on and on and on and on and on. That's the revolution. That's what's taking that civilization down. That's what will destroy political Islam. So that's why people like Ben Shapiro are, I think, willfully ignorant about that, because Ben Shapiro is a conservative, right? He believes in class. He is a true. He's not inconsistent. He's not like Milo. This is why I respect him.
Yeah.
I'm not like him, but I respect that. He knows who he is. He believes basically in traditional American values. He thinks the nuclear family is what we should all be in. He's not so fond of homosexuality and abortion and, you know, non-marital sex and all the rest of it. So he's not a big fan of what's coming in the satellite through the satellite dishes either. So he's not going to trumpet that. He wants to protect Israel.
Yeah.
Because he's Jewish conservative and a Zionist. And he wants to expand American influence. But America meaning formal American influence, meaning the formal culture of this country.
Not true cultural freedom. Right.
Not popular culture.
Exactly.
Always been at odds with formal, what I call formal American culture. So formal American culture is what the politicians and the school teachers and the business leaders say, the stuff that they try to teach us. Popular culture has always been antagonistic to that. That's been what's been on the radio and what's been on television and how people dance and the music they listen to and the movies they watch and the porn they view. Porn's huge. And the clothes they wear, huge thing. You're supposed to wear a business suit, right?
Mm-hmm.
How many people wear business suits? How many people wear business suits in music videos? None, zero.
Right? I mean, right.
So, you know, if you're a woman, you're supposed to look like Hillary Clinton, right? That's what formal culture says to us. how many women want to? Some, but most don't. And certainly pop culture presents women in a totally different way. So that's to me, the real struggle, both in this country and abroad. And that's what the book's about.
Excellent. When do you anticipate that it will be done?
Right now, I actually do think it will be published in fall of 2017.
Terrific.
Next year.
And how can people in my audience learn more about Renegade University? And if anything, what can we do to help?
Yeah, everything goes through my website, ThaddeusRussell.com. Renegade U is right there when you go to the site. And you can sign up for my newsletter. That's the best thing to do. And you'll find information coming at you about it throughout the year.
Awesome. Well, I wish you the best of luck. And hopefully we'll be able to have you back in the near future for a progress report, for lack of a better phrase.
That would be fantastic. I would love that.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Thad.
Thanks, Brett. Find yourself a girl and settle down. Live a simple life in a quiet town. Steady as she goes. Steady as she goes. So steady as she goes. Your friends have shown a kink.
Hey, everybody. As you know, I haven't produced a lot of podcasts since we wrapped up our memory series in the beginning of June. I think today's show is like the third one I've done in the last month. But during that same time, I have worked my ass off on creating content for the School Sucks Project bonus content section, the AV Club. So in June, as you know, I spent, 9-10 hours plus a couple hours of prep on the Dawn of Freedom, plus a bunch of hours in post-production to add that to our bonus content section. One day before that, I drove to Connecticut to be on the Tragedy and Hope subscriber-only show that I do get to post into my subscriber-only section, too. It's called The Deep End. It was me, Rich, Daryl Becker, Kevin Cole, Rich's friend, and now my friend, Dylan, and we talked about the Orlando shooting. I'm editing a 3-plus-hour conversation that I'm going to be calling Philosothon. That's like a conspirathon, except about philosophy. I recorded it in June of 2015 with a very bright young man named Matthias von Gutenberg, and we talked about his philosophical journey. We didn't agree on much, but it was a fascinating conversation. Last week, I recorded another 3-hour show. So marathon's a real theme. Over the last month in the School Sucks bonus section, with Andrew Mercer from Puke and the Gang and Brian Sovereign from Sovereign Tech on Tesla Motors and the politics of the automotive industry. And that's something that I thought really wouldn't interest many people, but it turned out to be a very lively and fascinating conversation that Andrew led and Brian and I participated in. And I think a lot of you would get, actually, surprisingly, a lot of value out of that show as well. So those are all things that are going to be added. Oh, and I've also recorded a bunch of stuff with Stephanie and Brian that you haven't heard yet. I have an enhanced video version of our Stanley Kubrick discussion, or at least the first part of our Stanley Kubrick discussion that's going to be bonus content. So I've spent a lot of time producing things that a lot of people don't get to see because that's what I've really been incentivized to do. I really, really appreciate the people who've made the School Sucks project possible since 2013, since I really stopped looking for tutoring work and tried to make a full-time go out of this project. And while I am incentivized to do that, and that's great, I also want to make sure that I am continuing to produce high-quality, challenging, entertaining, and educational. I'm just telling you what people tell me, folks. Series. Like the series that I did with Thaddeus Russell in 2014, like the series that I did with Wes Bertrand, lateral to that, called The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem, like the productivity series that we did at the beginning of this year. So what I've done, and you can see this in the show notes for today's episode, is I have set up a Patreon page where people who don't have time and really don't care about all of this bonus content, I understand how many people there are competing with me for your time and attention. But if you really want to incentivize the creation of quality educational series and podcasts for the people who need them most, the young people whose attention and time is being sucked into so many disastrous causes and pursuits today, political and activism campaigns that really are not going to have a positive outcome for anybody. You know, I want those people, and I'm working hard on ways to reach them, but I really also need to be incentivized to continue to create content to hopefully reach those people. And we set out with a really, really important mission for this show, and I still want to fulfill it. And I don't have, you know, and if you heard the show that I did with John Vespasian about thinking like an entrepreneur instead of like a crusader, I'm not trying to change the world anymore. But I've received, at this point, 7 years into doing this, hundreds of emails from people saying that, you know, this show or something about this show or even just something that some guest that I brought to this show, something about it changed their lives. And if you think about the leverage that has, hundreds, perhaps thousands of people who've made significant changes in how they live, in how they think, in how they communicate, I think this show has had a tremendously positive effect. But I feel like so much of my time and attention has been redirected into the creation of what I would call premium content in one form or another. And this is something that I've really been struggling with over the course of the last few months. Like, if I have to make a decision to continue to do this show as I do it, we average about 8 shows a month, and that's been the case over the last several years, or transition into the creation of online courses, well, the responsible decision is definitely the latter, as things stand right now. So I'm asking for your help. I'm really shooting for like 100 people who will become patrons of the School Sucks Project on Patreon.com. I'm going to ask for $1 per content item created. And this is the first show that I'm putting into the Patreon campaign. And the shows that I do in July, which will be based on another theme that I'm announcing very soon and I'm very, very excited about, will also go into Patreon as well. And most of the content that I deem valuable enough to get me $1 from you over the course of the rest of this year and next year will wind up there as well. So check the link in the show notes and help keep this message free and available for the people who need it most, the young people. I was really, really moved by the number of listeners who already contribute every month. When I asked, this was probably over a year ago now at this point, consider sponsoring a young person. And, you know, it wasn't like 150 people who did it, but a handful of people doubled down on the amount that they were contributing to the show and says, this is my, you know, this is my scholarship fund for the young person who needs this message. And young people have gotten this message. And you've heard a few of them on the show in the past. And I'm hoping to bring you more in the future. But with all that, I really need your help. So click the Patreon link in the show notes and support us that way. Incentivize the mass distribution of educational content. Thanks, everybody.